Thank you, Mr. Yost. I have two questions, and then I suggest what you do is you take note of the questions, because I'm going to ask members if they want to add to the questions, right, and then we can finish up. But you want to just explain to me, a senior education specialist.
Yes.
Give us a sense of your function, firstly. Secondly, your work environment. How many other education specialists are there? Do we have enough in Gauteng? You know what I'm asking you,
yes.
Right? So that's the first question. The second question I think you need to perhaps focus in on is this issue of, yesterday we heard about content as well.
Yes.
Now, to make clear the content and to map what you were saying, clearly mapping out content,
mm.
What practically, what are the tools practically that we would need? What would be the process that we would need to embark upon to get that right? Because it seems to me that if that gets sorted out, then people can deal with pacing, they can deal with everything else, because they know this is what I need to achieve for the year. So that's really the central issue there. And then lastly, because you raised this issue of literacy and so on, I am quite flabbergasted every time I hear that kids cannot read and kids cannot write. Because you can't possibly be saying to me that we are teaching at a level that has got any value at all for a child if a child has passed through the foundation phase and is unable to read. Should we be looking at special interventions such as, for example, introducing literacy periods as opposed to merely focusing on specific subjects, particularly in your foundation phase for the first 3 or 4 years, depending on whether we're including grade R. But actual focused literacy periods every single day, as opposed to the kinds of priorities that we're now having around what do kids do at that level, like languages or whatever else we do. I mean, not that you can do literacy without a language. But it is very worrying to me that we can go through, you know, up to, what would you say, grade 7?
Grade 7.
Unreal.
Mm.
We're teaching those, what, 7 or 8 areas in the intermediate phase.
How are kids
actually coping with that? How do they write exams if they can't read? So there's something fundamentally wrong, I think, with us being so focused on the advanced aspects, should I say, of OBE, and not dealing with basics. Members, let me throw open the floor. Dr. Kloppers-Lawrence, Ms. Mashishi.
Mr. Yester, you mentioned that this curriculum is of an international standard, but who designed this curriculum initially? Was it piloted in the schools? Were the teachers trained? Is there a set of criteria according to which these curriculums were designed? I think it links up to Ms. Chauhan's question about the process. And then, who's going to do the revision? And are you going to pilot it? And are you going to train the teachers? Why are we having this problem in the first place? It should have been done right in the first place.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you very much. I just want to ask about the task planning.
Yes.
When I check here, I see only group of learners. Is it part of the assessment? You only assess the grouping of learners, or do you also do some individuals? And again, you talked about the interpretation that is not clear. What is your proposal on that one?
And then the other one, you said the content is lacking. I need clarity. Thank you, Chairperson.
Sorry, the last component there? The content. Okay. All right, the first part is about our unit, basically. I think curriculum delivery and support is a unit in each district, and it's then divided into phases, foundation phase, intermediate, senior, and then FET, further education, which is 10 to 12. There is a senior education specialist for each learning area in each phase. So in foundation phase, you'll have for the three learning programs done there, numeracy, literacy, life skills, and then there's also a person for assessment, and then there's also a coordinator which coordinates that subunit. And so it goes through right up to matric. FET as a coordinator, facilitator, we sometimes known as subject facilitators, a facilitator for each learning area or each subject, with a coordinator and an assessment specialist for that phase. So that's basically how we are structured. I firmly believe that there are vacancies, obviously, but I firmly believe that most districts have the people that they need. In Gauteng as well now, we have all received the opportunity to apply for cars. Previously, there was a big problem with vehicles getting around, etc., etc. But in Gauteng, they've allowed each specialist to actually apply for a state vehicle, get a subsidy, get out to the schools, because that is one of the biggest problems we have. We support schools directly, so we need to be there. Normally, we had to go out in teams, wait for pool cars. You know, it's quite a problem. But in Gauteng, I know that will change soon. But generally, our working environment, I think, is good. Our obvious problems are we do have a lot of resistance from unions. All right, that I must say up front. Just as you know, we had a lockout in Alexandra for the last 2 weeks. We were not even allowed to go into any school in that area due to the unions doing that, basically. We are generally not allowed to go into teachers' classrooms, which is where we should be. And I think this is a very important aspect that needs to be negotiated with unions. That teachers are, facilitators are actually allowed to go into classrooms. We are in a supporting role. We're there to help to develop teachers. But if we can't be in their classroom to help them, you know, it just becomes a question of checking your documentation, is it in order, and then going away. We leave a report, but we don't actually achieve anything. We follow up, we find the same problem keep on persisting. There's no really change to that. Now, as far as the content is concerned, content can quite easily be mapped out by specialists in the fields. We all know that there is the Foundations for Learning campaign that's going on, and that is actually very nicely mapped out, and achievable milestones have been set for learners to achieve term by term. So teachers have got a very set structure that they can follow to say, as far as reading is concerned, this is what the child must have achieved by the end of term one. Then it builds onto term two, term three, and then they must have achieved all milestones by the end of the year. What I'm proposing is something very similar, where the content gets mapped out and the teacher can then term by term measure the child's knowledge and then obviously skills and values as well. So I firmly believe that content can quite easily be mapped out by, you know, people who are in those particular areas. Literacy is and the language policies in our schools is a very, very complex thing, because we do have 11 official languages, which makes it very complicated. Learners are taught in their home language up to grade 3, so it could be any language. And from grade 4, and I think this is where our problem starts, most learners switch over to English as their language of learning. I think grade 4 teachers especially have a big problem. They cannot end up failing the whole class. There's too much documentation to complete. She rather leaves it, and those learners progress with that problem. And so it persists, and we're talking about 2-3 years down the line, and they are sitting in grade 7 without being able to read in English. So that is where our problem starts. So if we can get policy that actually says, and I think it has sort of come in now, where learners must start with English in grade 1, whether it's as a second language, but they must have two languages where English must be one. That's quite important. So when that switchover happens, it automatically happens in all our schools. When they go to grade 4, we do not have a single school in our area from Alexander right through to Ivory Park where any of the learners learn in any language but English in grade 4. And if they do not have the background, it's quite disastrous. And the progression and the promotion requirements actually prevent, and the legislation prevents the teacher from keeping those learners back if they're not ready. So we have a big problem there as far as that's concerned. Now, sorry, and there are many other aspects around language, but it becomes quite complex. But I think that's the core of where the problem starts. The curriculum is, as far as I know, in line with OBE curriculums across the world. The problem is that content, as I said, is not very clear. There are some learning areas where there's recommended and suggested content, but it doesn't actually show enough detail for teachers to know exactly what must be done as we go from term to term. The piloting, as far as I know, the curriculum was not piloted, and if it was piloted, in very selected schools. But I do feel that I'm not sure whether this committee is responsible for the revision part or the review part, but that has to happen. It's inevitable.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Who was responsible for the design of the
curriculum? No, Ms. Dr. Clopas Lawrence. He's not finished answering. Let him finish,
sure.
And then we'll...
Yes. Okay. Just quickly on that. As far as I know, it's national. National education. The task planning, yes, learners do activities in various ways. So some activities can be done individually, some activities can be done in pairs or groups or whatever. OBE does encourage group work and facilitates learners doing activities in groups. And sometimes the teacher can assess their ability to work in groups and what they can achieve as pairs or as groups. But some activities, especially those that are recorded assessments done during the term, should be marked and assessed by the teacher, and it should be done individually. But it can also be done in pairs and groups. So those are also important skills that learners need to learn. I think is that fine? Thank you.
Just very briefly, right?
Okay.
When you say that legislation prevents teachers from holding back students who are not ready.
Yes, okay.
What precisely, which legislation, what section, where is it that says,
okay.
Where it says that?
I don't have it with me, but I think it's Gazette 23...
Okay.
I can look it up on my
computer. What you do is let Mr. Brown have
yes.
it.
The actual
so
legislation.
We can have a look at it.
It's from 2007.
Yeah.
There's been some revision in the meantime, but there's all kinds of informal policies going on as well, where schools are told not to fail more than 5% of the learners.
Yeah, but you see, if that's not the law,
yes.
Then that becomes a matter that you guys must handle in your department.
Absolutely.
What you said was that the law prevents teachers from holding back a learner, which
okay.
is just, it's doing a disservice to the learner.
Yes.
And clearly that can't be correct, that the law prevents a teacher from doing his
yes.
or her job in an appropriate
way. I think legislation requires...
Let us have that legislation,
yes.
And if it needs fixing up, we'll fix it up.
Okay.
So give it to Mr. Brown as
I'll
soon as
there.
Possible, okay? Thank you very much, Mr. Yusser. And let me just say to you that we have Ms. Chubeka here from the department, and she's obviously looked at your submission as well. there is that curriculum review process that is happening, and I hope that certainly as an education specialist in the Gauteng department that you guys are very, very involved in that process. We will in any case take your submission and send it through to the department, certainly the all three of your submissions, and of course your recommendations pertaining to content and so on have been echoed in other submissions. So thank you very, very much for your participation, and please convey our best wishes to your colleagues. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Who is next? Miss. Yes. Well, let me just get somebody else to be ready in the meantime. Is that Miss Glenny? Okay. Miss Chobeka? While you're getting ready, Miss Glenny?
Thank you very much. Yeah. Just one thing around the assessment policy. It's captured in a policy, the GET assessment policy, which we'll give you. And what it actually says, it's linked to the curriculum, that no learner should repeat more than once in a particular phase. So trying to ensure that children progress with their age cohort and they're not left behind too much. But that's the policy, which is currently under review in the NCS implementation review work. And just in terms of the question about who developed the OBE curriculum, just to say it was a broad-based team, not national, involving schools, teachers, and education specialists. I just thought I should put those two into the book.
Chebeka and Ms. Glenny, over to you, 10 minutes.
Madam Chair, Honourable Minister and Honourable Members of the Committee, I have a presentation which has been circulated to you, if I may indicate when we turn the pages, in order to keep you to where I'm intending to go. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to participate in this really important process. My name is Jenny Glenny. I'm the Director of SADI, which is the South African Institute for Distance Education. It's a non-profit organization established in 1992, driven by a social justice mandate, committed to quality lifelong education for all, and we have been trying to build access with success since 1992. If we turn over the page, I'm proceeding today from five premises, some of which get forgotten, which is why I want to highlight them. The first and most important is about our need to design a schooling system with the needs of the majority in mind, not the needs of the top 20%. And I think we sometimes forget this. We refer in much of our work as the majority as the mainstream, just to highlight this. It is extremely painful to me, after 16 years after the advent of democracy in our country, to have research findings quite often that come out showing the high performance or relatively high performance of the top quintile, but the almost standardly dismal performance of the next four quintiles. And one often has that sort of bar chart of performance with quintile 1, 2, 3, 4, and then quintile 5 up there. So I think it's really important for us not to get carried away and think that all our schools are going to be able to move terribly quickly in a whole range of ways. The second premise is that the textbook is one of the most effective tools through which to deliver the curriculum and support assessment. This is a well-known research finding and is also highlighted in the Department of Education Review Report of 2009. Obviously, it's not only the textbook but other learning materials that are equally important. The next and important premise is that teachers are key to the success of the basic education system. Without teachers, our system is not going to operate properly. We can't replace them through some other means. But I think we do need to remember that teachers need to be supported, and teacher guides are one of the important ways in which this should happen, and I've given various of the functions that I think might occur through teacher guides on my slide there. And finally, and I think this is really extremely important, is that teacher development should be prioritized. One of the key findings of the review of Curriculum 2000 was that professional development was neither properly conceptualized nor implemented. And when one went through the review, that actually was one of the outstanding processes of the review process, was exactly how that professional development was going to be prioritized. So I would like to make three propositions from my submission. There are more in there, but I want to highlight three of them for this presentation. The three that I put to you stem from work that Sadie has done over the last 5 years, and these three propositions are as follows. That we should seriously consider the notion of textbooks and other learning materials as open education resources, and I'll explain further what that means. Second, that we should urge a more standardized and coherently distributed teacher development process. And finally, we want to stress the importance of schools as centers of care and support. As I say, this all comes out of work that we have done over the last few years. Turning to the first proposition around textbooks and open education resources, and this is on the third page of my presentation. There is now an international movement underway with large numbers of participants. It's working extensively at the higher education area, but also moving down into the schooling and further education. It's called the Open Education Resources Movement. What are open education resources? They are resources that are available for educators and learners without an accompanying need to pay royalties and license fees. The beauty of OERs is that they can be used, they can be adapted, they can be reused, they can be adapted further, and they can become very, very widely available, particularly through our increasingly technological environment in which we all work. And one can do all of this legally, because there are now appropriate licensing frameworks which allow one to do this. The most common of these is called the Creative Commons license, and if I'm the author of something, I then say that this bit that I have produced, that this may be used by anybody, and I give them permission to use it. In some cases, I give them permission to use it as long as they attribute me, and I often give them permission to reuse it and change it as long as they then make it available to everybody else again. In particular, I think there is growing consensus that any material developed from the public purse should be available as open education resources. And I'd just like to give you an example. The Kellogg Foundation provided us with resources to develop a book on learners and learning some years ago, which was aimed at teacher educators and students and student teachers. This book is now available through our website. You may download it, you may use it, you may change it, you may do whatever you like with it, as long as you then attribute it to us. We are now able to work through print-on-demand facilities, and this book is available at 45 Rand if people would wish to purchase it. I think this provides for us an entirely different way of operating, and I'd like to draw your attention. This might be a comparison with what we think now about music and the ability for us to download music through iTunes and other such possibilities. This concept, we believe, can be used to maximize the cost effectiveness of textbooks, and there are various moves in other parts of the world, in California at the moment, and I understand that President Obama is also looking at ways of setting aside money from the public purse that would allow for the common, for putting a huge amount of time and effort into the development of educational resources and making them freely available for teachers and educators to use. This has two advantages. One is that those teachers who need a great deal of support have very easy access to materials in the kind of way that the previous speaker was talking. But then those teachers who are very skilled and comfortable may also take those resources and adapt them, and then whatever good things they do to them, they can then recirculate them for others to use. So in this respect, we would like to suggest that one should have a team of subject learning experts who actually build core texts for each subject at each grade. And it doesn't have to be a single text, it could be more than one text, but to provide the kind of guidance, kind of sequencing that was suggested by the earlier speaker. These could be released as open education resources on Tutong, for example. I don't want to sideline publishers. I think publishers have an important role to play, but perhaps they'll have a different role to play, and that might be about adaptation in a particular language, in a particular province, and also would obviously be a printing and distribution role. So I think one would engage with publishers for them to try and assist and work with them to develop new business models rather than the current ones which they have. I turn now to my second proposition, which is around teacher development. And this emanates from extensive work that we have done with the Department of Education and also working with a range of higher education institutions in the country. We believe that there should be a more standardized, and coherently distributed teacher development system. Let me elaborate on the first. In respect to the more standardized teacher development, and particularly at the inset level, and I'm on the page which says two teacher development at the moment. We believe that we should require higher education institutions to cover the essentials of reading instruction methodology, especially in the home language, as well as in English as a first additional language. This might sound obvious, but recent research found that only two universities offer this. Madam Chair, this issue of reading is absolutely key. When I hear of learners not being able to read in grade 7, I really fear for our future. It's not only that we have denied those children opportunities for their futures, but it is also, imagine the extensive alienation you would feel if you sit in a classroom and you can't read. I'm a maths teacher, and I had kids in my classroom who couldn't count, and I knew how alienated they were, but that was only one period a day. Imagine being sitting in a classroom for 5 or 6 periods in a day and not being able to read. It must be the most alienating experience in the world. I believe that we've got a lot of the basics there that we just need to use, and I'd like to draw your attention to something that the department has done, which is the Carrie Gooder campaign. The minister will be familiar with this. Literacy materials are available in all 11 languages, which systematically assist people, and as it says on its spine, learn to read in Sepedi. And these are guides which have been developed with linguists, with people involved in training of teaching reading, and have been shown to be really successful. Now, these are aimed at adults, but the methodology there could be employed in all sorts of ways. The second area that I would like, I just wanted also to point out that these are available as open education resources. So again, one could adapt them very easily and make them available to teachers as they please. Secondly, I'd just like to highlight the importance of teachers' own language improvement. And finally, I think it's really important, and again it seems absolutely obvious, that in pre-service curriculum for teachers, pedagogical content knowledge is absolutely key. We have to ensure that our teachers know the content that they are about to teach. And some universities don't seem to believe that it's important for them to propagate the understanding of and ability to teach that content. I'd like now to turn to the issue of the teacher development system.
I think you're running out of time very seriously, so I want to suggest that you leave that part or just maybe wrap up to the best of your ability so that we can engage with you a little bit.
I'll certainly do that. The 2 points that I was making there was about it being integrated between the different actors in teacher development and with a distributed and ongoing responsibility to get teacher training as close to possible as the site in which teachers will actually be working and not far from that site. And finally, I just want to address the issue of creating caring schools and put 2 propositions there. One is that I really think we should be seriously looking at a 7-hour day for schools. And there are a range of reasons for this. Children, we know, have not got the appropriate learning environment at home in order to, for example, do their homework. It's not supportive in many, many cases. And we have school buildings that are there. We now have computer labs which are there. A recent study that we've just done says that in Gauteng, 60% of the schools, those labs are not available to kids after school. This is crazy. We have resources. Why don't we make them available? And this would have a number of advantages, which I have highlighted in my penultimate slide. And finally, through work that we have done over the last 4 years, I just wanted to identify a sort of model of a school as a center of care and hope, which we drew together from the work that we did and also with the work with the Median Education Trust in KwaZulu-Natal and Northwest. And it highlights the different components of a caring school and suggests that one of the most important aspects is to think about how that school can be supported by other NGOs, by government departments, in order to create the caring school for teachers and for learners, at the same time as not forgetting the importance of the curriculum. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Glennie, and I'm sorry that we've had to fast forward you on some of these issues. But might I just say to you that a lot of your ideas and your postulations were are very sound, I think. And certainly the issue of the workbooks is a notion that we raised with the department a long time ago. So there are many aspects of your presentation that I find quite intriguing, not least of which is the issue of the open, accessible kind of tools. And maybe you would want to just explain what are the challenges in the South African context, if there are any legal challenges to this kind of concept around textbooks in particular, because, I think that the situation currently is satisfactory in any way. One of the other issues that is raised is that, of course, textbooks themselves that are currently in use are kind of all over the place, and that we don't have a uniform system. I know that the minister's on record as saying that henceforth the department wants to look at a centralized procurement system as opposed to the kind of system that we have at the moment. But that's really a resource issue in terms of trying to save budget-wise and so on, and not necessarily looking at things like the content of textbooks. But the thing that I am also very, very interested in is this issue of caring schools and homework classes. And really, we have a lot of learners who are unable to sit down at home because there is no space for them to sit down at home and do some studying, do some homework, do research, the kind of assignments and projects that many learners have to comply with as part of their assessments and so on, become almost impossible to do in certain areas in our country. And clearly that is a fascinating idea, and one that I know is being sort of informally adopted in some communities, but not necessarily everywhere. Members, I don't know if you want to add any questions, comments in this regard. Dr. Klopas Lawrence, no? Mr. Skosana, no? Oh, yes, okay.
Your third slide, integration of sport and cultural activities, would you like to embroider on specifically the sport? Because we've read in the newspapers during the weekend about this draft policy on sport in education. Would you like to embroider on that, please?
Okay. And then maybe I could just ask you, please, to give us more information. You know, one of the things that strikes me, and it pertains to the previous submission as well, is the issue of literacy and how it is so important for teachers to know how to teach to read. And you're saying to me that studies have found that in training teachers, our universities are actually neglecting, firstly, the curriculum broadly, but secondly, the methodologies in terms of just imparting literacy, which for me is a shock, I must say. So if you would just please, I know that you've put it down here as a footnote on one of these pages that I read earlier. Oh, yes. It says, similarly, the PIRLS 2006 research found little evidence of dedicated teaching of reading in schools. And also found only two universities offering reading instruction in an African language. But are universities actually training our teachers to teach reading is really the question that I have. And if you've got empirical studies to show this, I would be very grateful, because certainly that issue has got to feature in our report.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The issue of open education resources and legal challenges. Obviously, current textbooks, the copyright will belong to publishers, and one is not allowed to do, to copy, to reuse, etc. But it is possible that one could, through the Department of Education, assemble a group of experts from the field. There are lots of people who've got lots of expertise in teaching, who've been doing it well, who might think and come together and develop a core text, which is not actually then, but it does not belong to the publisher. And it may well be that one should resource those people to develop the materials really, really well. If I may just point to the British Open University is renowned for its curriculum development. Why is it renowned? Because it actually spends extensive time and energy of putting those materials together, which are then used throughout that country. So a similar kind of process here, that one really gets the best brains together, most experienced, and resources them in order to produce really good textbooks based, grounded in the classroom. And that one then releases that. So you pay those people for doing their work, and they never get paid any royalties, because there is no such idea of royalties again. And this work then is released under Creative Commons license. And it is made available. Now, not everybody has access to the technology, only some people do, but it's made available on a digital platform. People can download it and use it and adapt it as they please. But you could also then arrange for certain aspects of it, certain sections of it, to be printed in an appropriate way at a provincial level, at a district level, or whatever. You have overcome the legal difficulties, because the department would in a way it would still own the copyright, but it would license anybody to use it and to adapt it, as long as one attributes it back to the Department of Education. And it sounds like a simple thing, but some people find it really hard to make that step. We've been fighting with HESA in higher education about a guide for teachers around HIV and AIDS, which they paid for developing, but they don't want to let people use it freely. So, yeah. There is now a legal framework in which one can do this, which is the Creative Commons licenses, and one can proceed from there. And the second aspect that you asked me to comment on, and if I may just point out that this, I think, would mean that whatever money we have for learning resources can go much further than it currently goes, and that's the important point, if you like, as well as the accessibility. The issue of being unable to study at home, I think that this is absolutely central. And it's really about thinking of an integrated day in which all kids would be working in some cultural activities, some sporting activities. It wouldn't mean the teachers are teaching all day. They would have free periods in which they would do their marking and preparation as well. But the idea is that you would have a structure for children, most of whose parents are working all the time, coming home very late. And again, it's the infrastructure issue. I really do think that we should look at it very seriously. My understanding of the conditions of service are the teachers are required to work 7 hours a day. It doesn't say that you only work some of those days at the office and some of them at home. You have to work 7 hours. So I think one should be really exploring this very, very thoroughly. I think it would have a mind shift as well about creating a supporting school. And then finally, the issue of the literacy training. The research that was referred to, I'm not sure whether the Centre for Evaluation and Assessment at the University of Pretoria has presented to you. They were in the public domain a few years ago, and the Minister reacted very positively to much of the work that they did. But it was their finding that very few universities actually structurally teach kids how to read, and particularly in the home language. And it seems to us that that's an absolute requirement, that you teach kids how to, you teach teachers how to teach children how to read. Without that foundation, we really are in a very serious position. Now, it is difficult for some of those institutions, because they will have learners there who are working in a number of different languages, student teachers who are working in a number of different languages. But we have to make a plan, and I think that the Curry Goody campaign has got a way of pointing us in order to make that possible at those institutions. And we are currently working with the University of Pretoria in this regard in their foundation phase, and working with them, for example, in Sepedi and Setswana as the two languages, in addition, obviously, to Afrikaans as a second language. And then the issue, obviously, of spending, you raised earlier, Madam Chair, the issue of having some periods. Some of the polls and findings were that, whereas in other countries, at least 2.5 hours, I think I'm correct from memory, is spent on teaching children how to read per week. In South Africa, it is around 1 hour. And the question really is, what do we do in that hour? Are we making kids read, or are we reading to kids? We obviously have to get children to read.
Let me thank you. Please, won't you just see in your archives if you can't get that study on what universities are doing in terms of teaching
full
reading
study.
Instruction. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That would be very useful to me. And if there's anything that you find that is more current on that subject as well. So thank you very much for your input, Ms. Glennie, and we certainly will look at your submission in quite some detail when we do process our report. Thank you again. And next we have from Junior Achievement, Ms. Linda McClure.
No problem.
10 minutes.
Okay. Thank you to you all for the opportunity, and thank you to Madam Chair. It is for me a real privilege to represent an organization that's been working in the educational field around business and entrepreneurial skills for over 30 years. My submission relates to the inclusion of entrepreneurial and financial literacy education programs within the school curriculum, providing a more holistic education experience. It is true that in even the best education systems in the world, many young people are not ever going to achieve academically or go on to reach tertiary education. And just to refer to Jenny's comment about, you know, the quintile five schools doing so well, but there's a dearth of other learners and other schools that are really struggling. And our programs all focus on entrepreneurial education, financial literacy, accounting, with a focus on enhancing the experience that they have in the mainstream school curriculum and creating economically active and responsible citizens. So all our programs focus on the key issues of financial literacy, workplace readiness, above all entrepreneurship, and we incorporate accounting, marketing, and business skills. I think we're all aware that the current school system is clearly failing our young learners. And the purely academic nature of it is, for me, one of the reasons. The curriculum does not provide for practical skills that foster a very deep understanding of the management of economics, business, accounting, and entrepreneurship. The curriculum also does not offer learners an alternative to going on to study further or gaining employment, which for many of them, the reality is that they won't ever be able to attain that for various reasons. Our programs focus, as I said, on numeracy, financial literacy, and accounting across the school curriculum, as well as soft skills such as social responsibility, ethics, personal responsibility, while instilling a very can-do attitude among the learners. Whenever I visit these programs, which I don't often get to do, unfortunately, as the managing director of the organization, one of the questions I always ask participants on our programs is what surprised them. And they all say, without fail, what surprised us is that we could do this. And that can-do attitude infiltrates right the way across every attitude, every approach to their lives, their schooling, etc. Examples of what we do, and we work around the country in both urban and rural areas, is on our Be Entrepreneurial program, we build the knowledge base not only within the individual but within the community, because one of the projects on that program is that participants and learners have to go out into the community to solve a social problem, and they have to involve the community in solving that problem. Our Exploring Economics program offers a very practical application of microeconomics. The primary school program, Enterprise Dynamics, combines financial literacy with economics with wonderful practical exercises such as following what we call Ronnie Rand throughout the whole economic system to understand how it works. The flagship program, the Mini Enterprise program, engages learners between the ages of 16 and 18 in actually starting and running a small business with all that comes with that in terms of management skills, accounting, which we find is always an enormous challenge. Even if the learners are accounting students and doing maths, the accounting aspect is always a part that we really have to focus on intensively. Our programs also assist young learners to identify what their particular skills are and to develop their skills. So although they might have, and not many of them do, but although even if they may have access to career advice and counseling, there is very little opportunity for them to explore their own particular skills and their own particular passions and to identify where they could, what they could actually do in the future. And our programs provide that opportunity as well. Our impact has been immense over the past 30 years, although currently we are reaching less than 1% of young people between the ages of 10 and 18. Our impact has been evidenced by proper external impact assessments that we've done over the past few years, but there's a tremendous amount of anecdotal evidence, such as a more positive approach and attitude to schoolwork, which came through from the principal of Mkuzi Secondary School in Northern Natal, where she said she could very clearly see the difference in the young, in the learners who've participated in the program and those who haven't, just even in terms of just wearing their uniform with more pride, getting to school on time, approaching their schoolwork with a more positive attitude. A young man from Mtata, as a result of participating in our programs, was motivated to study further and managed to get a loan and is now studying at NMMU. An alumni of an enterprise program is running an extremely successful panel beating business attached to our Tambo International Airport. It's the only panel beating business in the world that is attached to an airport who works on your car during downtime while your car is parked there. He's now negotiating with Cape Town Airport and Durban to start up businesses there. Another of our alumni, Simbiso Shabalala, funded his entire university studies, is now doing his honors in accounting, through the running of small businesses, the skills that he learnt on our programs. Our methodology, which we understand to be unique in the teaching and transferring of the entrepreneurial and business education skills for young people, has contributed enormously to our success. The methodology is learning by doing. All our programs are extremely practical. Participants have to engage. It's not a matter of somebody standing up teaching. They have to physically do the work. We transfer a range of skills across many, many subject areas. We also train carefully selected and suitable educators. And the training of these educators has proven that they can have provided them an opportunity to transfer their skills into other aspects of their teaching. And we're all here because we are concerned about the education system and the lack of teacher commitment and training perhaps, but really, you know, there are many, many teachers out there who are doing their best. And we select those, and those are the ones who work with us very, very intensively and passionately. Although our programs are currently offered as an extramural activity, they're a very easy fit into the curriculum. The high school programs are offered after hours. The primary school programs, educators are already making use of them during the school hours, given the fact that in many cases it's very challenging to run extramural activities for primary school kids. We believe that through participation in our programs, learners are much better equipped to manage to cope and master accounting, mathematics, financial literacy, and also providing them with an opportunity that once they do graduate from school, they are better equipped to provide for themselves economically. The softer skills that that we combine in our programs and that in many cases is just a spin-off go a long way to reducing the effects of difficult socioeconomic circumstances, and that might lead to criminality and teenage pregnancy. Our programs are applicable in both urban and rural areas. We're very flexible. We adapt them as necessary. The rural learners, and there hasn't been specific mention of rural learners, but they do face very specific challenges. So we have made sure that our programs are applicable as in the urban environment as well as the rural environment. We have also run programs in schools for learners with special needs with great success. We are currently in the far stages of discussions with the Gauteng Department of Education, who want us to launch a whole range of programs for grades 8 to 11, starting in the school holidays, working specifically with the 276 learners from the 276 identified underperforming schools in Gauteng. And we are hoping that we will be able to launch that successfully during school holidays and then continue into the second half of the year and be able to report back on that at the end of the year on the impact. And we believe that, we really do firmly believe through our experience over 30 years that the inclusion of these programs in the school curriculum is absolutely essential to provide opportunities for young people outside of the mainstream of the sort of academic nature of the curriculum. And that if South Africa did include these programs, we'd be joining many other countries such as China, USA, UK, who accept and acknowledge the importance of this type of education within the school curriculum. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McLew. I think that the issue that you raised is absolutely crucial in the sense that, and it's come up again and again. Yesterday we had a presentation from the School of Skills in Cape Town, where their curriculum is actually more practically orientated, where they actually impart a skill and, in a sense, could be called a vocational school as opposed to a school where you study towards a matric, which is really meant to prepare you for further academic study. And as we know, one of our big challenges in this country is the throughput and flow through our school system is not exactly something that we could be proud of at this stage. The reasons why and so on are complex, but I'm quite sure that one of the reasons for it is we do not cater for the ability and capability of young people who are practically orientated, who learn by doing as opposed to reading and so on. So clearly a program such as yours, well, I haven't got a single clue as to how it actually works.
Yeah.
It sounds to me as if it's geared towards filling that gap and perhaps, you know, also at a broader level and from when you were speaking, I realized that I've often said we're a very abnormal society in the sense that because of our past, we don't have role models. We don't have people who have uncles who own businesses. We don't have people who have aunts who are surgeons and can actually then follow in their footsteps. We have such an abnormal society that at best people are looking around and wanting to become teachers, nurses, but mostly people go and study HR because everybody else is doing it,
yeah.
Or admin, everybody else is doing it. But nobody would actually think of becoming a marine engineer because there are not many of those around in our society. And then in our schools, and particularly in our high schools, we don't actually have a proper vocational education.
Mm.
So kids are not able to even contemplate their future in a particular way. And again, it seems to me that this kind of program assists in that regard by actually placing kids in a particular situation where they have to think differently, do differently, and start processing their world more holistically,
yeah.
I think, is the
yeah.
point that you're making.
Yeah.
But maybe you want to just give us, I see in your haste to present to us, you didn't delve too much into your background and the background of your organization. And perhaps you wanna just talk to us. I know you've already said, you know, people have to work with the community and so on, but what kind of things do they achieve once they've been through your program, in the sense that, you know, here you've got a problem, this is what needs solving, how do you go about solving it? And maybe you can give us some practical examples of how young kids have actually come out of their shell and actually managed things that we sometimes, I think, underestimate
yeah.
our young people a great
yeah.
deal. Members? Ms. Chubeka? Oh, Ms. Mashishi?
Thank you very much, Jefferson. On your submission, I'm impressed that this program of yours will be starting from grade 4 to 7. But I was suggesting that why can't you start from grade 1? At least maybe they have a little knowledge from grade 1, and then until they go to grade 7. And you also mentioned from 18 years to 20?
Yeah.
4 years. Well, thank you, Chairperson.
If I could just answer the second question first. The programs are offered from ages 10 right the way up to age 25, actually. We do work with young and out-of-school unemployed people. We are doing some quite extensive work in the Sasolburg and Secunda area as well with young people who have now got to there's a particular age where they have to leave school, even if they haven't passed. I don't know what the politically correct term is, but haven't achieved, and they have to leave school. And so we are also working quite extensively with that group. So we don't have programs yet for grade one, but they are being developed. And I agree with you entirely, and I think that's one of the reasons for our success, is that we are reaching young people at that age. We're not waiting until they're 16, 17, trying to get them as young as possible. Just a little bit of a background of the organization is we are part of an international organization that's been around for 90 years and is working in 123 countries around the world. In 18 countries in Africa, we're the oldest in Africa, having run for 30 years. We work across the country in both urban and rural areas. Our methodology is having a small team of people who work in Johannesburg on a full-time basis, and we contract people around the country. So wherever we're working, and we work in Bankstrift, which I had to look up on the map, and Kwakwa and Mthatha and Kaskamahook, as well as Cape Town, Johannesburg. So we really do spread ourselves around very extensively, and we contract with people in those environments very strictly to make sure that they meet our standards of quality. And also, it would be absolutely useless for me to go in and try and teach a program in Kaskamahook. We have to use people from within the community, and particularly in the rural areas, somebody needs to fundamentally understand the situation in the community. Well, this wasn't even in a rural area, but if you're not using somebody within the community, you can run into certain problems, such as we ran a program in Westbury in Johannesburg, which is known to be a very problematic area in terms of gangs and violence. And we combined learners from Westbury High and Coronation High, and it was an absolute disaster because the kids from those two schools hate each other. So it just proved to us that we really have to understand what's going on in the community in order to effectively run programs. If I can just comment as well on the role models, I agree entirely. We try and get young people to come and speak on our programs who the learners can identify with. So it's all very well to talk about a Richard Branson or Bill Gates, but that's completely outside of their frame of reference. But if you get a young person like Richard, well, I don't know how young he is, but somebody who, Richard Maponya, who starts Maponya Mall, I mean, he's, that's somebody that they can identify with. So we do try and have role models speaking on the programs. And the focus for us really is a change in attitude, which is why we try and work with kids as young as 10, because if you can inculcate a change in attitude towards your life and the opportunities and to think a bit broader, so that they really do become functional, economically active citizens. Some examples, I did mention a few. I'll just talk a little bit about a program that we were running at a little sort of bridging school, I suppose is what you can call it, called Eden Campus in Sedgefield. And these are young unemployed matriculants, but who have had, you know, they didn't achieve very well at school at all, so their opportunities are extremely limited. And they are being provided with additional English and maths classes, and we providing the business education component of it. And I think one of the fallacies and one of the beliefs that these young people have is firstly the attitude, well, I can't do it, which our programs change, but also that they can't do anything without any money. And this particular group, when they started their business, they obviously had to have a little bit of money to purchase raw material for whatever product they were going to be making and selling. And they just sat back and said, we haven't got any money, we can't do anything. And the facilitator said, go and earn it, because you have your own labor that you can sell. Go and earn it. And the story that I love, and I repeat this all the time, is one of the students' names was God Given. And he walked around offering blessings. And he'd go up to people and say, my name is God Given, can I give you a blessing for R5? And he made 250 rand. And I think that is what our programs do, change that attitude and approach so that they really can do it, and change the myths and fallacies about, well, it's just too much of a big ask to do something on my own. We have a young man in Mpumalanga, in a very rural school in Hazyview. He was on a program sponsored by SPA, and SPA have been very engaged in the program. And he was elected as one of the managers in this company, and he was so impressive, and his leadership qualities came through to such an extent that SPA have now actually employed him on a part-time basis during school holidays, and they'll probably take him on, you know, because he had the opportunity to excel. I think in the mainstream schooling system, somebody who is not coping will pull back. And, you know, we'll never know what potential they may have. We have wonderful examples throughout Africa as well of young people. There's a young man from one of the slums outside Nairobi. And as a result of all the riots, he was the only young man in his whole class who survived. All his schoolmates were killed. So he comes from really, really difficult circumstances, living in the slum. And he's just done fantastically well running a small business, producing these little bracelets, you know, and really doing exceptionally well. So the opportunities and what we try and do is provide some ongoing mentorship and support, putting them onto other organizations, individuals that can help them, and there are many, many people who want to do that. So, you know, for me, it's just a no-brainer.
Thanks, Ms. McClure. I really think that if we had more time, we would be able to spend a day on your program. Mm. A small story about a man called Tony Factor comes to mind.
Yeah, exactly.
And about how he just was unable to achieve. Mm. I think he was even dyslexic and
yeah.
so on. And went on to become one of the foremost business personalities in our country.
Exactly.
So clearly it's programs like yours that would really mean a future of absolute dismay as opposed to a future just sparkling with potential to some kids. And,
yeah.
and that's really the difference your program would make
yeah.
to a person's life.
Absolutely.
So thank you very much for your time, for your submission to us. What we hope to do with, and you did mention that you do work with some of the education departments, yeah, and so on, which is very heartening. But one of the things that we hope to suggest to the department in our report is to actually have a kind of an accreditation kind of process, where organizations, NGOs in particular, offering the various programs could actually feature on the Department of, yeah, Education's database, so to speak, so that, yeah, when schools actually feel the need for certain programs and so on, they have an easy and accessible way to, yeah, to communicate with people such as yourselves, most of you being NGOs. So hopefully that would be one of the things. And hopefully if you do have events and so on, you will invite members of the portfolio committee.
Absolutely.
We'll be very keen to come and have a look and meet some of your participants. Thank you so much.
Perfect.
For your time.
Pleasure. Thank you.
How are we doing on time? Are we all right? Okay. Let's then move on to Izingani there too. We have Masaba. Mrs. Ramatlo.
Yes.
And
Mrs. Kaba.
Mm-hmm. Both of you from the same organization, I take it. And both of you are going to be doing the presentation?
No, I will do it.
You'll be doing the presentation, and then both of you will be responding to questions and comments.
Yes, definitely.
Wonderful. Welcome, and you have 10 minutes.
Thank you. And Chair, I have to apologize up front. We just brought a memory stick and hoped, you know, we will be able to fit in. And this battery is challenged. So if it goes off, I will be talking off, you know, off the cuff. And please stop me if I read on and it's doing it already. Okay. I'm Muiponi Ramato from the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund. And I'm with Shadi Kwaba, who is a specialist in the particular program that we're talking about. Izingane Zethu is an initiative of the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund, which it implemented with three organizations on the ground in the KZN. And these are Tree, the Valley Trust, and Little Elephant. The reason behind this particular program is in 2002, a study was done on early learning, and it was found that 80 to 89% of children in South Africa were not able to access early learning education due to center-based models, and most of it due to poverty or inaccessibility of the centers. And the initiative was started by NMCF in KZN and also in Guruman, Tusano, but the presentation today is based on Izingane Zethu in Natal. And the context we were coming from was that all children need basic education at that age, not to six, because we were told by experts that it is the building phase of any child. You know, what goes wrong at that age will affect that particular child for the rest of his life. And if 80% of our child population does not access that education, that was very worrying for NMCF. So we started this initiative with two organizations, that was in Kuruman and in KZN. And the idea was to take early learning to home, to the home. So it was a home-based kind of program. And the issue there was that family facilitators would be trained on all aspects of early education, and they would take that to the family, train the family members so that they could then impart the education to the child. This was done very well, you know, in both areas. And the outcome of all that was that when these children were assessed at the end, and the children were also linked to center-based programs where once or twice a week they would go to a center-based program, those that could access it, just to interact with those children to see, you know, that they don't lose out, and they would also be taken to libraries in those communities that would have the libraries. The outcome was that when these children were assessed at the end of the day, they were found to be performing much better than children from center-based programs. And the analysis there was that these kids have the advantage of 24 hours interaction with people who, you know, were skilled to stimulate them. And this is the caretaker or the parent at home. And whereas the center-based child was at the school for about 4 or 5 hours and then had to go home, where the parent is not linked to the school at all. So we thought this was very exciting. We continued the program from 2002 until now. Now, the context that we are coming from as NMCF is that besides the children that will not be able to access the school, the education at that age, there was also our communities are burdened by disease and poverty. And we all know now that this country is sitting with the highest population of children heading households and children without parents. And for us, that is also key to the development of our children. We believe as the NMCF that education does not happen out of context. It is part of the ecosystem that must be developed for the development of our children. And this ecosystem is made up of the teachers, the school governing bodies, the communities, the NGOs, and, you know, government resources. And if there's coherence in all these resources around the child, then the product that we come out with at the end of the day is what we need for this country. But what we found is that yes, NGOs are doing their best. Government is also providing services in terms of education and whatnot. The home is isolated from both. And we believe that with the context that I described earlier of children heading households or very old people looking after children at home, some of them as old as 80 looking after children younger than 10, if we don't take that in context when we educate our children, we're not going to achieve what we want out of that the education. And the other context is that there's a very high dropout rate in our communities. And this is precisely because the resourcing of our schools, the gap is so huge. When you look at the upper quartile of our schools and the lower quartile, the gap there is amazing. It's not, what we heard this morning was that the performance between the schools is so different. I'm not surprised that it is like that. It's because when you look at the schools, how, you know, the gap, just the teacher training, just the school itself and its resources and its environment, it's so different. It's no wonder children are not performing. And the NMCF is very concerned about that. The other thing is that our schools have become the most dangerous places for children to be in. And we think the Department of Education should take that into cognizance when they plan for the future and the curriculum for the children. Because based on the fact that what I described earlier, children coming from very depressed homes and the insecurity in schools, with some of the teachers being the perpetrators of abuse and hostility towards children. We've had Satu come out and say, those teachers who may have abused children, we will protect. And our worry is, who is there for the children? So if that is the context our children are going to study in, what do we hope to come out with at the end of the day? And we are saying, therefore, as part of our recommendations, somebody must be there for the children. And we recommend that there should at least be a social worker, accessible social worker in each of the schools, you know, in almost all our schools. First, to protect children and provide security, and secondly, to understand the context from which the child is coming from. Because if there is no correlation between the child at home and the school, what the school expects of the child, and there's no one there to present the child's case or at least to ensure that this particular child is able to access the support and the resources that they need, we are not going to be able to get far. And unfortunately, with the huge numbers that we are dealing with, it's a big chunk of our population. And secondly, we are saying the security in the schools must be beefed up. Our schools cannot afford this. We've got 7-year-olds going to the toilet and coming out raped. For me, that is just not acceptable. And schools should be centers of excellence and learning and not where children are even afraid to go. So it has come to that. And I'm worried because I've got nothing to chew me, so if I'm rattling on, please stop me. The other thing that we were worried about in terms of the context is that somebody did mention earlier that the homes are not supporting the education system in the sense that children have got to research, to do a whole lot of research to produce the kind of work that is expected in the current system. So we recommend that schools be kept open, those that have the facilities, to enable those young people that are not able to do the work at home to be able to continue and to at least be level the playing ground, you know, with everybody else, and access the resources that are just not available at home. And those, I'm talking about something as basic as electricity, you know, to be able to do the work. And, of course, if you go further up, computers and, you know, all the information that children need. So if we can keep our resources open, especially in depressed communities, to enable children to at least be able to deliver what is expected of them. And the last
recommendation? I think we were also emphasizing the fact of after school care support. I think which is one area that you are looking at, that there are no families for their children, mainly most of them. So it is important to actually look at some kind of a formal after-school care support for those children that are not having anyone at home to assist them with their homework, to, you know, look at their well-being and all those kind of things. I think it's one area that we're also emphasizing.
Okay. Thanks, Sari. Based on that, you know, the Izingane Zethu program has been able to survive and do well up to this point, mainly due to the family facilitators that were trained by our partners on the ground and were supporting the families at home. So we are saying, and having proved that the program works, you know, for 8 years, we think it should be formalized and scaled to cover communities that, you know, are similar to the ones that we worked in, like Kranskop, Senthakau, and Kuruman, which are very remote and rural, but we're able to produce the kinds of results that we're looking for, at least at a basic learning, you know, the foundation phase. So, yeah, in short, thank you.
Thank you very much for that. And let me just say that one of the reasons why we called you to participate with us this morning was because we needed to understand your program a little bit more, this program of family facilitators, and particularly how it could really... do you want to put that off? How it could assist with the difficulty regarding access to preschool education, particularly in rural areas, where, as you say, centres are not available easily and so on. And maybe you want to... No, not now. We're going to ask questions. You're going to write down the questions and then you're going to respond, right? And both of you can then, between the two of you, respond to questions that members have and so on. But you may want to just give us, because your submission, unfortunately, didn't have too much of empirical data around the successes that you're claiming. So, for instance, this a notion of saying, well, kids do better if their mothers or their caregivers are empowered to impart some basic skills as opposed to a preschool sort of formalized environment at a center and so on, is not something that we have got. And maybe you want to give us a little more information with regard to the empirical data that you may have collated. How is it that you assess these kids and how much better did they fare and so on? But then also give us some information about what it takes to train a family facilitator. How many of those do you have on the ground in the two projects that you do have? How many families have you been able to reach and how many children as a result? Just in terms of one of the big things when you make proposals to government is always, what are the financial implications and how would that be more cost effective then having a center-based solution, which you say is not necessarily always practical. So those kinds of details, which you may not necessarily have on hand now, but you may want to give us in a separate written submission, right? Members, Mr. Skosana, anybody else? Happy? How are you, Mr. Kanyahu?
No,
welcome. Go ahead, Mr. Skosana.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me start by apologizing for coming late in this meeting due to some commitments that I had in my office before I come here. Chairperson, this is a very wonderful presentation, and it's worthwhile. In fact, it's, let me say, it's having an impact on the ground in various areas. I'm talking about the development of this fund that we're talking about here. But, Chairperson, there is one thing that I want to request from this fund, this Dr. Nelson Mandela Fund, Children's Fund. If they can have offices in different provinces who will try to consolidate their development, really they are doing a lot, but their development is not realized. There are a lot of people who are benefiting from this fund, but the only thing, it should be having offices in various areas in order to consolidate your development. And it's not well known in other provinces. They just hear about it, but they don't know exactly how does it work. And also, I must say, As you are saying, you are concerned about children and their social well-being, etc. It's very important, really. A learner is not, in fact, a learner when that particular learner is at school alone. Even outside the school premises, is still a child who needs care, and you are taking care of those children. But let's try to spread your operation so that you can realize your effort and your development on the ground. Thank you.
Well, son, I don't know if they are here representing the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund. They are in partnership with them on this particular project, so I imagine that you'll carry that message to your partners. But maybe you want to just respond to some of the other issues, particularly the ones that pertain to the actual what do you call it, family-based preschool?
In one community, we have one side. We have, I think, about 7 villages, and in 7 villages, we have about 20 family facilitators. Per annum, per month, we spend, I think, about 1.5 as a stipend. And for training, we can spend about 10,000 per family facilitator, because you are looking at giving them information about early childhood development, what is that you need to do, how to stimulate children, and all those things. So those are kind of expenses that is involved when trying to do this kind of work, especially looking at the content and capacity building of those people. We are also looking at about 400 families. And within 400 families, we'll be looking at about 1.2 children. These are children that you are preparing them to go to schools. Most of the children are between 3 and 6, but will go to from bed, where you look at caregivers while they're still having babies. Or making sure that, you know, their environment is in such a way that a child is in a very nurturing and a very supportive environment for the development of that child. So it's basically about how do you make sure that the family is part of the development of the child, and those children that are unable to actually access ECT services, we're able to make sure that they get those services within their family setup. And we use the ECT not only to make sure that the child can count, the child knows that, you know, I'm wearing a green jersey, but you have a family, you are able to also improve the quality of life of that child, because we also have through the reports, through the learnings, we're able to also observe that there's actually a very a correlation or relationship between the self-esteem of a child and the quality of life of his or her family. So those are the lessons that are coming out of this interventions. In terms of the data, we'll be looking at the number of children who have never been to a center, but through the family-based ECD that are now accessing, that are now in grade one, and others have actually even completed the grade 12 because we started the program early in 2000. So I will be able to give at a later stage that information that says, you know, how have they performed. We now even have the youth forums of the children who are part of the ECD program. So it's a very integrated kind of intervention that looks at only not only about the child that is able to count and do all those things, but, you know, growing a young person that is responsible, that is able to make, you know, those appropriate and correct choices.
Maybe just to add on that, you said how different is this from a center-based model. When we go into a home, we also look at issues like, is this child registered? You know, do they have legal documents? Because those are very critical, you know, issues that people don't even look at, but they make such a difference to a family. For instance, when the family facilitators go to the house, they look at the caregiver. Is she an old person? Is she even accessing her pension? The income security of that particular family, do the children get grants? Do they have birth certificates? If they don't, part of their program is to ensure that that family, when they leave it, has got all the legal documents that enables them to unlock government services meant for children, which gives them income security and also enables the family to support the children when the family facilitator pulls out. As part of the work they have to do, of course, is the ECD training of the little ones within that family. So that's basically how different it is. But the other thing is that whilst ECD centres have got a limit in the numbers that they can take, with family facilitators, the numbers are bigger. So the exponential factor comes into play there, because one facilitator can look after 10 families. That means more children that can, you know, access education, which may not be possible with centre-based models, especially in depressed communities.
How long does it take to train a family facilitator, and then how long does a facilitator actually spend with one family trying to impart a lot of this skill and capacity?
The ECD training, remember, there are different levels. So for year one, they'll be looking at, you know, either level one ECD, depending on their we look at their educational qualification. You have those that went to school to up to actually standard 5 or grade 7. So then we look at how we can train those. So it depends on the level. So they will use for year 1 or year 2, it will be level 1, depending on how quickly they can grab the content. And it differs. And this program, we're able to, for each and every year, we had the capacity building built within that program. So it has been 8 years where we actually look at the training. Sometimes it's also a formal, and then we also have informal training where we look at the children's rights programs and all those. So we combine both formal and informal training. And the second question was on? With the family, because of the distances and all that, we'll be looking at 2 days per for each family per week. In a week, they will visit one family for 2 days, and then I'll have to actually confirm that. But I think it's about two days per week.
Yeah. Maybe you want to give us, by way of written submission, some of that empirical stuff and budgets and so on that I've asked. Because for us to as a committee, to recommend it to the department as a possible solution for them to investigate, particularly around rural areas and so on, it has to be supported by a whole host of empirical data.
May I hasten to say that the reason that we cannot give you the actual facts, you know, about the training on the ground is because our partners, the ones that we mentioned earlier, are actually ECD experts, you know, your trees, your lettuces, and your Tusano, and these are ECD experts. They would give you all that that kind of information in terms of how long does it take to train a family facilitator and the context of the training. But we will coordinate all that information and forward it to you, just so we
That's
give the
wonderful.
The
format. Thank you very much. And Ms. Chubeka wants to say something.
Thank you very much. It's just when they make additional information available to you, to ask whether they can look at whether this role of family facilitators can be played by community development workers, just to see how we make that link. Because I think we just want it formally so that we can make those connections. Because I think it has great possibilities even for job creation and just reach. But the other thing is how much they pay for the stipends, because what we're finding is that ECD and grade R, because they've been looked down on, we tend to almost abuse people at that level and not pay them much and not look at how they can grow and pay them stipends that are not sustainable. Just to provide more information on exactly what it is that you give them, that makes it. Maybe not now, I don't want to take up the time of the committee, but in providing the additional information, perhaps those are some of the issues you could add. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Chubeka. And if you could just make note of all of that and make sure that when we do receive your submission, please just take Mr. Brown's details so that that can be easily facilitated. Members, we've done very well. I want to suggest a 15-minute body break. I've got tons of complaints about yesterday's session where we sat right through without any tea and body break and so on. So well done to all of you. I see you've learned the lesson I taught you yesterday. So let's take a 15-minute break, and then at a quarter past, we will be on time to hear Lawyers for Human Rights. Are they there? Oh, okay, great. So you'll set up in the meantime, and we'll take you immediately when we get back. Thank you. much. I was looking for it. Thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to mail you, and then will you send it to me? Thank you very much.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Okay.